the science guy. Bill Nye the science guy.
Bill Nye, the science guy, is our guest this hour of the program, and he's going to be in Madison next Tuesday, speaking at a free public event on Tuesday, August 31st at 7 o'clock. NASA's Venus Exploration Analysis Group is sponsoring the talk, Impacts Planetary Climates and Venus. It's been arranged by the Space Science and Engineering Center at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and it focuses on what Venus can teach us about Earth. Bill Nye is with us this hour of the program, 45 minutes, first 45 minutes, and then we will have another guest with us, the planetary scientist and director of the Office of Space Science Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so it should be a fun hour and an extremely informative one. At that, our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Bill Nye.
Greetings.
Greetings. Thanks for being with us. I didn't know Carl Sagan was your professor.
Well, I mean, there was a class of many, many people, and I was one of them. I mean, he wasn't like Bill Carl.
But you were the star. You're a star student, right?
I don't remember that.
You don't?
Yeah.
Oh. Do you remember being taken, though? Was he one of the people who influenced you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he was just riveting. I mean, he was a fantastic lecturer.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, these pictures from other worlds were a new thing. Now, you go on the Internet, you get any picture you want of anything. But in those days, he would get off the plane and... from Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, with a pack of slides. You may remember color slides.
Sure, I remember.
Color transparencies through which you projected bright light, and then they would show up on a screen. Anyway, we would see pictures that very few people on Earth had ever seen before. It was amazing.
Yeah.
And his take on things, his point of view, was fantastic.
Uh-huh. Oh, he was fantastic. Let's talk about, you are... Vice President of the Planetary Society. Let's talk about the Planetary Society making some news last week, I believe it was, sending a letter to the chairs and ranking minority members of subcommittees considering the NASA budget. You're in favor of taking off for other planets, but you have some problems with NASA's budget. What are they, Bill?
Well, the word problems, I don't have any problems with NASA's budget. We think the new plan is great. And I say we, the signers of the letter, or, if you will, leadership, leaders of the Planetary Society. We think the Obama administration or the present administration is on track. The thing that's come up that I found so surprising is the idea that people want to keep the space shuttle flying. Now, the space shuttle was canceled 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
canceled during the previous president's administration, during the George W. Bush administration. And so the reason it was canceled or finally wound down was the space shuttle is an old system that needs a lot of maintenance, and the money that goes into that takes money from all these other fabulous programs that NASA might be doing. And then the other thing is everybody wants to go someplace new. Let me ask you, how many people have flown in space?
You're asking me?
Yeah, take a guess.
Oh, well, okay. I would say 250. No.
That's pretty good.
Is it?
Well, it's 500. It's over 500.
Oh, it is? Huh.
So if I ask you to name anybody that's up in this International Space Station right now...
Don't have a clue.
Yeah, no, he does. And that's not a bad thing so much as it's the way it is. That is to say, so many people have flown that space travel has become routine. So what we want to do is take us to someplace new and exciting.
Yeah.
And so the new and exciting place, really, for humans is Mars. And Mars, to get to Mars is a very difficult thing. And is going to take many years to get there, but the longest journey starts with a single step, and you've got to stop. We strongly believe you have to stop spending money on a system that is just being maintained to go to old places and start spending money on these new and exciting places.
Mm-hmm.
What happened, apparently, people didn't want to, especially corporate leaders, didn't want to lose the jobs of their employees.
Oh, sure.
Apparently, and I say apparently, and if somebody knows a better reason, he or she should come forward. But apparently, they're very concerned about jobs. And then people in our business, space advocacy business, feel that using the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, to create, if you will, as a jobs program, is probably inappropriate. NASA is associated with adventure, with excitement, with new destinations, not with this other approach.
Right.
So, I'm so reluctant to get horribly misquoted. So.
And going to Mars, you would have to go to the moon first and then go to Mars?
Well, I don't. We strongly don't think so.
You don't?
No, absolutely not.
Huh.
There's very strong technical reasons that you don't have to go back to the moon. You know, going to the moon is a big gravity well, as we say. You have to go down to the moon's surface, and then you've got to launch again. And it takes a lot of energy. In fact, going to Mars and just going around it and coming back takes less energy than going to the moon.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
It's an interesting thing.
Landing
on Mars and all that stuff, that's a whole other. But it is an interesting sort of, how to say, celestial mechanic thing.
Hmm.
So we really want to get started on this, and that would be going into deeper places in space. Fabulous places everybody's interested in mathematically and from a rocket science point of view is this place called Lagrange points. French mathematician who solved the three-body problem. There's the gravity of the Earth-Moon system, the gravity of the Sun, and then the gravity of you or your satellite. And so he solved that problem. And so these places, there are places where the gravity is, and the gravity and the orbital motion around the Sun are nearly in balance. In fact, well, they're theoretically exactly in balance. So you'd go there, then you'd go to an asteroid and learn about asteroids, because asteroids could be serious trouble for people on Earth someday. And then you'd go to Mars. And the reason you want to send people to Mars, people are just very good at exploring. And we build these fabulous robots, and I'm a huge robot guy. Don't get me wrong. I worked in a tiny way on the Spirit and Opportunity rovers. I'm on the Mars team. And it's cool. Big fun. They do amazing things. But, you know, these vehicles have been there for 6 years, and they've gone 20 kilometers. This is something, if you were in just reasonable shape, you'd do in a day. No, but really.
Right, I got you.
And the scientist, and I don't want to misquote him, but the principal investigator, Steve Squires, has remarked many times that what the very best robot technology does in a day, a typical geologist does in about a minute. So if you could get, if you had a really interesting place on Mars to go, you would justify sending people to have a look. It wasn't until the very last moon mission that a full-time scientist, Gus Schmidt, went to the moon. It was the very last person to walk on the moon. Now, with all this said, people would say, well, why go to Mars? That's a waste of time. Oh, my friends. If we found evidence of living things, and this would be nominally would be fossil bacteria, it would change the world. Not overnight. People would still go to the grocery store and stuff like that. But it would be a whole nother perspective on your place in space. It would be like Copernicus discovering or pointing out that the sun is in the middle of things, not the Earth. It would be like Galileo discovering that other planets exist, and furthermore, the other planets have moons. This was a quite unsettling in the day, but it would just enrich everyone's life on Earth.
I always thought that it would take some kind of being from another planet to change our world.
Oh, that's a fabulous science fiction idea. You'd have, yeah, when you have an outside enemy, and that really is
outside friend.
No, it's the Cold War, which is I'm a huge fan of the Cold War. No, I mean, I'm glad it's over, mostly over. But
right.
the reason people went to the moon, the reason the United States sent people to the moon was because of the Cold War. There are many space enthusiasts who insist that it was for the greater good of scientific discovery, but I think that's not a very strong argument. The reason people went to the moon was to get there first. Furthermore, I remind everybody, the former Soviet Union did all this stuff before the United States did. Lunar landing, lunar sample return, brought back some rocks from the moon, all robotically. But it didn't count, didn't get to be a big deal until people walked on the moon. The Beatles were a big deal, but they were a bigger deal when they got on the Ed Sullivan Show. So
right. So going back to where we go and whether or not we go to Mars, I know you've written to the Planetary Society, to these congressional subcommittees. Who ultimately, Bill, is going to make the decision where now in space?
Well, if I were king of the forest, no. It's another thing you work out. Like, for example, the DPS is coming. The Decadal Planetary Survey is coming up. This is where scientists, researchers, and a few engineers get together and decide what to do next, where to go next, what are the unanswered questions to address next. And so that's what will be happening in October.
Mm.
It's not October. It's coming right up. The International Astronautical Federation is in October. That's coming right up. You don't want to miss that. But
no.
As far as where people go next, I think my understanding is it's up to Charles Bolden, the administrator of NASA, who, by the way, very supportive of the new plan and is a former astronaut. He's a shuttle astronaut. Well, former. He's an astronaut. He's a shuttle astronaut. Marine pilot. Fought in Vietnam, flew a few shuttle missions, and wants to go someplace new.
Hmm. Well, so you got the right guy in the place at the right time.
Well, to our way of thinking, but there has been a tremendous political movement to not change things, to keep the shuttle flying. And people are very concerned about what they call the gap. This is where the United States will not have rocket access to the International Space Station with rockets made in the United States.
Mm.
Well, I remind everybody that happened before when the Columbia blew up, killed seven people.
Mm-hmm.
Challenger blew up the space station. That wasn't really a problem. But when the Columbia blew wrecked, smashed, tore apart on reentry through groupthink oversight or whatever you want to call it, the United States, rather, did not have access to space with U.S. rockets for more than 2 years. And look, the world is still spinning. It's okay. You gotta move on.
Mm-hmm.
That's our feeling.
Yeah. Let's go back to these asteroids, because you said something that I'm sure piqued a lot of people's curiosities listening. Listening to you, asteroids could cause serious trouble. How so? What do we need to know about them?
When I was young, the school teachers would tell you the best theory that was extant at the time was dinosaurs died out because they were too stupid. They had small brains for their bodies, and that they were dumb, and they died out. And that was sort of the best theory. It was fine. How about this? Let's put it another way. They couldn't adapt to the changing environment. Like that.
Okay.
Well, then in the 1980s, guys were looking for oil in Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico. In fact, deposits similar to where the oil, Deep Horizons oil well blew up, and they found this ring of magnetic anomalies This is to say the Earth's magnetic field was disturbed in a very easily, or to them with their instruments, readily observable pattern, which was a big meteorite impact. And so people got to looking at it. They found these freshwater springs in a big ring around there. It took sort of 3 years to really convince everybody that it was a meteor impact. And apparently that's what killed most of the ancient dinosaurs, was an impactor from space. Now, it happens, you know, that only happens every million years. Well, okay, what if it's in 2037 or something? You know, it's coming right up.
Right.
So you want, there's a couple things about asteroids. First of all, they're very hard to see. Huh. They don't reflect a lot of light, so, or a lot of radar. So these things are fantastically distant, moving very, very fast. They're not readily observed until it's late in the game. Secondly, there's all sorts of objects out there with gravity, and you can get the what you believe is the trajectory very accurately, but it gets disturbed. You only can assign a probability of it, whether or not it can hit the Earth. You can't say for sure it won't hit the Earth or for sure it will. You can say, sure looks like it won't. Pretty sure it won't. And then the other thing, the asteroids that I'm talking about are pretty well understood, but not completely understood. That is to say, sometimes they're loose aggregations of rocks held together by gravity. So somebody says, well, let's just put a nuclear weapon out there and blow it up, and that'll nudge the thing off course. Well, wait, what if it's made of a bunch of little rocks and you end up with a shower of rocks? Just for example. That's just for science fiction,
yes.
Not crazy example. So we'd want to understand these, want to characterize these as best we can. And I'm sure if there are other civilizations on other star systems, they have this problem solved. A worldwide, a planetary civilization can exist for many millennia without solving or addressing the asteroid deflection problem.
Bill Nye, the science guy, is our guest, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. Let's take them right now, 800-486-8655. He, of course, is vice president of the Planetary Society, and it's hard to go on with his resume because he's done so many things. He's an engineer. As you can tell, he's a comedian, an author, an educator, an inventor, Emmy Award-winning television writer, producer, and host, and he's going to be in Madison next Tuesday, 7 o'clock, and it's a free public event. And it's been arranged by the Space Science and Engineering Center at the University of Wisconsin. So it should be, a great deal of fun. Two phone calls for Bill Nye, the science guy, in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I forgot to tell you where the event is going to be next Tuesday. It is the lecture hall of the Monona Terrace Convention Center. All right, let's go to phone calls for Bill Nye, the science guy, Carl in Winona, Minnesota. Hi, Carl.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I'd like to hear your opinion or what you know about the elevator system people are working on. If we had something like a spider silk or advanced carbon fiber tethered to the Earth and then to the space station or the orbit and speculate you could have a elevator system for lifting, is how is that, if that's developing?
Well, it's a cool idea. It's a great idea, everybody. So you'd have a tether, you'd have a rope that would lead up to something in geostationary orbit. That is to say, far enough from the Earth's surface where its very fast rate of orbiting is exactly matched with a point on the Earth's surface. And this is what we do with the communication satellites that comprise the global positioning system, GPS system. GPS satellites are geostationary. Okay, here's the problem. We do not have any material. There is no material strong enough to pull this off. If you made it of steel or fiberglass or what have you, the weight of the steel or fiberglass reinforced plastic, whatever you have, is so heavy that the thing couldn't hold itself up. It would fall apart. It would break. But since the discovery of carbon nanomolecules, these are Buckminster fullerenes, buckyballs, that are about a billionth of a meter across, these things are fantastically strong, just crazy strong, 10,000 times stronger than steel. And they would weigh about a sixth as much. If you could make cables out of these, you take the spheres of the buckyballs and stretch them into fibers. This material would be strong enough to pull this off. And to this end, NASA sponsors competitions. I guess the European Space Agency also sponsors competitions. How would you crawl up this fabulous tether into space? And then the other thing, when you go to build this, you can't have it break. You cannot have a 36,000-kilometer rope smashing around on your surface. So we will cross that bridge when we come to it. I tell people, don't let your babies grow up to be cowboys. Don't let them grow up to be doctors and lawyers. Let them grow up to be engineers. That's what we need. I say we. The world needs engineers to develop these materials so that we can, dare I say it, change the world.
Hey, change the world. All right. We'll keep that in mind. Give us just a tease of what you're talking about next week. Impacts planetary climates in Venus?
Yeah, so everybody, Venus is hot. Now, this may be a surprising result. Venus is quite a bit hotter. Surface of Venus, rather, is quite a bit hotter than the surface of Mercury. Mercury's much, much closer to the sun, twice as close to the sun, if you will. And you might not expect that. You think if you stand twice as close to the fire, you would get four times as hot,
right,
or something like that.
Yeah.
Well, this is not the case. And the reason is the Venusian atmosphere is so thick. How thick is it? It's so thick that it creates this amazingly strong greenhouse effect. The surface of Venus is hot enough to melt lead.
Wow.
Lead metal would be liquid. It's furthermore on Venus, if there are any of them, have sulfuric acid rain. It rains sulfuric acid. Now, wait, there's more. The rain doesn't get to the surface. It evaporates before it hits the ground on Venus. The acid rain, where it's hot enough to melt lead. Venus is, by sort of Western reckoning, like hell. So the thing that happened on Venus is they got a lot of carbon dioxide, and it got fantastically hot. Isotopic inspection, looking at the number of neutrons in the oxygen molecules of the Venusian atmosphere, makes us think that it was once quite wet. But too much carbon dioxide accumulated in the atmosphere, cooking off the rocks and stuff, that now it is, by our understanding, completely unlivable. So if you like to worry about things, and I know that many people do, many people thrive on worrying about things.
Of course they do.
You are living at a great time. This is a great time if you're a worrier, because what's happening on Earth, the climate changes that are happening, would lead one to think that the Earth could end up like Venus in not that long, in a surprisingly short amount of time.
Really?
So this is why we have, we compare one planet to the other, comparative planetology.
Yeah.
And so I am very concerned about climate change. Now, just today, it's the hottest, it's going to be the hottest August on record, it's the hottest July on record. This is the hottest decade on record. This is the hottest, it looks like it'll be the hottest year on record. If you like to worry about things, you are in great shape.
Well, we better get out there and change the world.
That's it. What we're going to do. We're going to change the world.
All right, Carl, thanks for the call. Let's go to Paul in Duluth. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Kathleen and Bill. I had my mind works in strange ways sometimes.
I can't imagine. I have no idea what that would be.
No, Bill has no idea. He's...
I've been thinking about these Chilean miners that are trapped 2,300 feet below the earth. And I heard a news report today saying that they could be down there. They've already been down there for almost 3 weeks, and they could be down there until Christmas. And it's a terrible situation, but I understand that they have psychiatrists and psychologists on the scene, and they're not telling these miners that how long they're going to be down there. And I think, you know, it's a horrible situation, but it seems to me that this would be a laboratory. These are not scientists. They're not engineers.
They're not fighter pilots. That's the people.
Yeah, and they could do an enormous. They could do an incredible. I mean, I hope these guys get out safely, but they could, for deep space travel. It seems like this would be a laboratory.
Sir, you're raising an outstanding point. I mean, I hadn't really thought of that. Maybe they will gather those data indirectly. Rather, not indirectly, but without setting it up as an experiment and have everybody in matching flight suits and stuff. Maybe we'll just learn a lot. Now, one of the mysteries, by the way, changing the subject ever so, a trip from the Earth to Mars, if you're punching it, as the kids say, about 7 months. If you're lollygagging, 11 months or 14 months, but 7 months. And nobody stays on the International Space Station longer than 6 months. So maybe we will figure out something if these guys are down there that long. The other thing about it, sir, that would be, I'm sure you've been thinking about this, is these guys didn't expect to get in this situation. So they have an expectation of getting back to the surface pretty soon. And that will that sustain them or make them crazy? This is a very good question.
Yeah.
And by the way, everybody, it shows you, when you see how serious this mining accident, it shows you how much we depend on these people who risk their lives.
Exactly.
All the time. I mean, you know, like we're talking on the radio, it depends on these exotic metals that you wouldn't have if these people weren't down there working.
Yeah, what a job.
Well, my uncle was a geologist. He worked in explosives his whole life, and he loved it, I must say.
Really?
He loved being underground. He liked blowing stuff up, and it was he wasn't trapped underground for many months at a time, eating through a tube from the surface, but there are some people to whom this is very appealing.
Mm-hmm. I just went into my first mine, the Sudan mine in Minnesota, on vacation, and I don't know if I had known how far down we were going to have to go in that little elevator, but it was fascinating to look at what they're doing, not only the history of mining, but also what they're learning about dark matter in this mine right now and neutrinos, and I loved it. It was really fascinating.
Neutrinos are fantastic things. Nobody knows what they are exactly,
right.
But they know that they are.
Right.
And you think about relativity. Oh, by the way, if you're an astronaut and you've been in orbit for a while, your time has passed a little more slowly than people on Earth, on account of relativity.
Mm-hmm.
And you've saved a few. Now, I don't know this number exactly, but I'm pretty sure it's less than a millisecond of your life has been you've saved. Everybody on Earth has aged a millisecond more than you have. But we discovered relativity in the beginning of the 20th century, 1900s. Who knows what physics we have not discovered? The physics that's out there, the nature of nature that we just have no idea about. And people 100 years hence, if we manage through climate change, people 100 years hence will look back at us, ha, 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 they didn't even know about co-relativity or inter-relativity or whatever the heck it's going to be called. It's amazing. Space exploration and science, how about this? planetary science going down in a mine is astonishing. Changes the world.
Yeah. Well, I want to hear about this electric car. We put a picture of you in your electric car on our Facebook page. Yes.
Now, which electric car? The Mini E?
Well, let me look at it.
Yeah, well,
I got too many
papers. I'll tell you
here.
About both of them. But the Mini E is a Mini Cooper, the guys, the BMW people that make the very popular.
No, this one says 100% electric, zero emission. There's a picture of you on the driver's side. It doesn't look like a Cooper.
Yeah, so I had that car for a year.
Oh, okay.
But the man comes and takes it back in June. So now I'm very excited about the Nissan Leaf. And I don't work for Nissan, okay? I'm not. But I'm very excited about it. I got to test drive it 2 weeks ago at the Plug-in Hybrid Show in San Jose.
Mm.
The next one next year, I believe, is in North Carolina. I think it's in Raleigh-Durham area.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it's a production car, and it's beautiful inside. Beautiful. It's great looking outside. And if you've never driven an electric car, it is the way to go. I'm telling you, it's so much more. It's just much more pleasant. It's quieter. You never go to the gas station. You may not be aware of how much time you spend thinking about getting gas. No, I mean, you're not.
I know.
You're used to it, yeah. But after you don't have to get gas, you really don't miss it. And the modern Nissan, the Mini Cooper would go about 100 miles. The claim was 150 miles, but this is always, in electric vehicles, it's always an issue, is how far does it really go? For me, it would go about 100 miles, 110 miles, but you never drive that far. You're not aware. You think you do because you're sitting at stop signs. You're waiting in traffic, stoplights. But you actually don't drive that far. There are a few people who do, to be sure. There are a few people that drive great distances. But most of us don't. So the Nissan Leaf, they say, is a 100-mile range. So I always say to myself, well, that's probably 80 miles. And just very few of us drive 80 miles a day. And furthermore, when the infrastructure is set up, here in California, there are places where it just about is. You go to where you're going, and you plug in there. So when you come out of your store, your school, your place of business, your dentist's office, whatever, what have you, the car's all charged up. You have a full charge. So you never run out. And the thing is, just spiritually, everybody, it's easier and cheaper to ship electricity than it is to ship gasoline. And if you think about it, that makes perfect sense. The wires are running. Electricity goes down the wires. You don't need tank trucks plying the highways, refilling gas stations, right?
Yeah.
So someday, if we can get all our cars, all our vehicles, first of all, just to be lighter weight and less inefficient, and then secondly, to be electric, and then we could just imagine having renewable sources of electricity, we could, dare I say it, change the world. And so the Nissan Leaf's a very impressive car. I'm very much looking forward to get it. The Chevy Volt is a good car. I drove that a prototype of that at a test track in Long Beach, California, and that's pretty cool. I think that could be a world beater. The Chevy Volt could bring U.S. auto industry right back. I mean, it is really a cool car. Now, it goes 40 miles on a charge, and then the gas comes on.
Right.
So for almost everybody, the gasoline engine would never come on, for almost everybody. And then if we had the infrastructure, really almost nobody would ever have to use the gasoline motor. It's a transitional vehicle that the Chevy Volt, but man, I was really impressed. Could bring Chevy back, could make the U.S. auto industry a great thing again. Very excited.
And when you talk about someday we'll all be together on this, when are you talking, a few years from now?
Well, as we say, people always predict the short-term future to be coming true much sooner than it really does. And people always make the long-term predictions much too long. These are old sort of futurist spiritual things. So everybody has an electric car in 30 years. Everybody has renewable energy in 100 years. Well, it's okay. It's somewhere in between. And as I say, if everybody really starts to appreciate the seriousness of climate change, if people really grasp this, really take a look at what's happening, we may get it done much more quickly. And by that, I mean get it done. Get to go to much less inefficient vehicles, much less inefficient electricity production. And so I always talk about my grandfather. I'll leave you with this.
Okay.
My grandfather was in World War One. Now, I mentioned that my grandfather, this is not a guy in the distant past that I read a biography of. Okay? This is my grandfather. He went into World War One on a horse. He put a gas mask on himself, and he put a gas mask on his horse. And you will be shocked to learn, Kathleen, he was a chemist. My grandfather. And he put chlorine in the Lister bags, in the canvas canteens, in the trenches. Nominally a dangerous thing, but he lived through it. And I guess drinking bleach is not as bad as dysentery when you're trying to
chew.
So anyway, he lived through this thing. But 20 years later, when my father was in World War II, nobody did anything like that on a horse. Nobody went into battle on a horse.
Right.
I mean, there were a few around, and there's, you know, mythic stories of these guys going cavalry, horseback cavalry against German tanks. But that's, no, nobody conducted war seriously on a horse. And that was just two decades. And they didn't have the internet.
Right.
Just think what we could do today. With the way we can move information around, the flexibility of our manufacturing, you know, you can mold anything into any shape now. We could just get it done if people got behind it. So I am optimistic about the future, and I think once people see the charm of electric vehicles, they will be embraced very quickly, and we can change the world.
Kathleen, this
has really been fun. I'm looking very much forward to seeing everybody. Next Tuesday.
Next Tuesday.
And come on down. And by then, I'm going to be moving from vice president of the Planetary Society to executive director.
In a matter of days.
It's the day after Labor Day is my first official day. So.
Well, congratulations.
Well, it's something that happens if you leave the room. And it's like you come back, hey.
Guess what?
Yeah.
While you were out changing the world.
Well, we're giving it a shot.
So, okay.
Anyway, thank you very much, and I'll see you all Tuesday. I got to fly.
Okay.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Goodbye, Bill. Goodbye. Bill Nye the Science Guy. And again, he is speaking next Tuesday, August 31st at 7 o'clock. He will be at the lecture hall of the Monona Terrace Convention Center, appearing with two other people, David Grinspoon and Jan Schmidt, on impacts, planetary climates, and Venus. And he gave you a taste of what that's all about, that we could learn a lot from what's happened to Venus. And it's alarming what we need to do and take action on, according to Bill Nye, the Science Guy. We're going to continue our conversation. And the next part of the program, a planetary scientist and director of the Office of Space Science Education at UW-Madison will be joining us. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us for the last few minutes of our program, Professor Sanjay LeMay, a planetary scientist and director of the Office of Space Science Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. That organization is bringing Bill Nye in for this talk next week. The office was established with the Space Science and Engineering Center at UW-Madison to conduct K-12 education and public outreach programs. And they emphasize partnerships between scientists and teachers in schools to develop standard-based programs that achieve the objective of improving the level of literacy for science, math, and technology education. Professor LeMay, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Hi.
And just a quick correction or a change. I'm here with Rosalind Persborn, who is now the director of the Office of Space Science Education. I just started, but now she's leading it since she had spent some time at NASA headquarters and learned a lot more about conducting education and outreach than I ever could.
Oh, well, you're going to have fun next Tuesday. Bill Nye, the science guy, is always a fun guy. Can you tell me about why you decided to have this major talk on planetary climates in Venus?
Well, it's actually being done in conjunction with a workshop on the Venus exploration issues and current results and future ideas that's sponsored by NASA. I lead a group of scientists called the Venus Exploration Analysis Group, which is sponsored by NASA. And so we are actually conducting a workshop in Madison next week, Monday through Thursday.
Mm.
And on the occasion of that, since there are so many similarities between Earth and Venus, we plan to have an event for public to discuss why we should explore Venus, since NASA has not sent a mission to Venus in a long, long time. Bill Nye comes from Cornell, and his colleagues are exploring Mars with these beautiful, wonderful rovers that have been roving the surface of Mars for many years. But NASA appears to have neglected Venus to some degree. But that's the most Earth-like planet in our neighborhood. And as we discover new planets around other stars, some of which may be Earth-like, it's important to know how and when did Venus' climate and Earth's climate diverge.
Right.
Venus, as you know, is extremely hot on the surface compared to the habitable zone that we live in. And today is a beautiful day in Madison. So we wanted to highlight some of those similarities and contrasts and see how the past events have shaped our climate on Earth. So actually the program will start with a presentation by Professor Jan Smit, who is probably one of the best experts on impacts. In fact, he's just left Amsterdam this morning. He's flying into Milwaukee today.
Oh.
And going straight to Upper Michigan to look at ejecta from an ancient impact in Canada, the Sudbury impact. That's one single impact produced or is responsible for all the nickel that's being produced in Canada.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, let's go back to Venus for a moment, which Bill Nye was talking about it being too hot. What would it take for us to understand why Venus got too hot, what the reasons for that were, so that we could take some action here to make sure we don't get too hot?
Well, excellent question, and that's something that we've been trying to understand. Venus has a very thick atmosphere. Most of it is carbon dioxide, which is a greenhouse gas. But that's not only greenhouse gas. There is water vapor also. And we have learned from previous missions to Venus, such as Pioneer Venus, on which we actually had some instruments. The Pioneer Venus mission had actually two parts. One was an orbiter, and it also sent three small probes and one large probe to Venus. And our campus, my center, Space Science and Engineering Center, led by Professor Vern Sumi and my colleagues Larry Sramowski and Hank Revercom and many engineers, built an instrument that Sumi was expert at, a radiometer to measure the amount of heat being absorbed by the Venus atmosphere. And that told us many things about Venus. That mission also confirmed that there was likely water on the surface of Venus in the past. So if there was water back in the past, and we don't see water now, we are pretty sure of that, what happened to that water?
Mm-hmm.
And did that evaporate and cause the planet to warm up? That's a significant issue, since, as we know, most of the surface is covered with water.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we were talking about is making sure in the last 45 minutes that we have enough people who are going into engineering. So as Bill said, they can go out and change the world. What astounds me always is I've said this for years, that the whole field of science and space in particular needs some kind of great PR, because that's the way we operate in America, agency. So you can make sure that all of these images, the one we had from Jupiter recently that got hit with, we'll talk about what it got hit with, so that we have an understanding of what we can learn from Venus. So you're trying to make sure that we have a new generation of people who are profoundly interested and will make their careers in science, in planetary science, et cetera.
Exactly. But I think besides just careers, I think a better awareness of what issues are that affect us is significant. And that's why Rosalind Pulsbond, the current director of the Office of Space Science Education, she has organized, along with the DPI here, a workshop for educators on Tuesday that she'll talk about briefly.
And in fact, I'm really glad you asked that question, because our workshop will specifically focus on encouraging the future workforce. And of course, half of that potential workforce is young women. And we're conducting the workshop on Tuesday in cooperation with the National Girls Collaborative, which is an NSF-funded organization that provides mini grants throughout the country to teachers and after-school organizations to support young women in particular and students in rural communities, which is, of course, quite predominant in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, to consider pursuing STEM, that's science, technology, engineering, and mathematics careers. And so in the early morning, we will have a Champions Board meeting for the Wisconsin and Midwestern Regional Branch to talk about issues related to supporting young women in their goals to pursue STEM careers, along with best practices that educators can follow. And in the afternoon, this goes back to one of the points you made, we will actually be using some of the Venus spacecraft mission from Venus Express, which is the European Space Agency's Venus mission that's currently active. Dr. LeMay and a lot of our colleagues who will be at that meeting are participating scientists in this program. And here at our Office of Space Science Education, we've actually developed some curricular models using that actual spacecraft data that targets middle and high school. And we'll be doing a very brief hour and a half demo in the afternoon to demonstrate to the educators and some of the students who will be coming along how they might be able to use real Venus data in their classroom. And I think this is unique. There's a lot of public support. There is a lot of public imagery out there through the internet and so on, but actually using the same data the scientists are using in the classrooms and having students model how scientists do research using that data is really quite unique. And so we're very much looking forward to sharing that with the educators from Wisconsin.
Wonderful. Would both of you say that we're at risk in not having enough keen interest so that people will pursue careers in these kinds of fields so we can find out indeed why Venus got so hot?
Let's see. There are too many questions in there, and I don't know if I can give a short answer. I think what we can do best is to promote the curiosity and the desire to understand how Venus got hot and what we can learn from it. I think taking action beyond that, as Bill pointed out, there are many possibilities, of course. But that takes, that's not science. That's sociology, economics, politics.
Yes.
Well, so we are focusing only on the things that we can understand.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to add something to that particular comment. My background was, as many years ago, I was a former science and mathematics teacher. And I think one of the real missing items in the classroom for teachers are access to actual products and resources that are used by the scientists to demonstrate to their students how science is really,
sure,
how mathematics can be used to support the science. And almost every teacher I talk with, and I know for myself from firsthand experience, knows that space is an inherently interesting issue to students, but how to accurately reflect what scientists and engineers do to become, to collect these wonderful images and analyze these images and make predictions about the climate on Venus and the climate on Earth. That's the one item that's critically missing, and that's what, that's the gap we're trying to fill by working closely with the scientists as educators here.
Yeah, great. Well, give us an address so people, is there a place that they can go so they can find out all that's going on tomorrow? I mean, not tomorrow, next week?
Yes, venus.wisc.edu.
Venus?
W-I-S-C, as in the first four letters of Wisconsin.
Okay.
.edu.
Okay.
And that has details about the workshop and public event. The doors open at, I believe, before 7 o'clock. We want to begin by 7 because it's a, I think it's, well, it's a regular work week, so we want people...
Sure.
Able to come and go home with it before it gets too late.
Okay, thank you very, very much for being with us. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing last hour and doing on-air production for both hours. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. Sounds like this should be quite an event in Madison next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.